Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Aaron Powell.
And I'm Trevor Burrus.
Our guest today is Ryan Bourne. He occupies the R. Evan Scharf Chair for the Public Understanding of Economics at the Cato Institute, and he is the author of the new book, Economics in One Virus, An Introduction to Economic Reasoning Through COVID-19. Welcome back to the show, Ryan.
Great to be with you.
I gotta ask, isn't it maybe a little ghoulish to use the pandemic to talk about economics or advance an economic agenda?
Well, I think economics, as we kind of broadly define it, is basically just about the study, the social science study of human beings making choices under constraints. And when a major event like a pandemic hits, with the kind of pervasive disruption that causes, we have to make a range of consequential decisions, an individual basis and at a public policy basis, which require thinking about trade-offs, thinking about the unintended consequences of those decisions, and so making economic judgments. So while I agree with you that on the one hand, you know, this is clearly first and foremost a public health problem, and there are value sets beyond economics that we'd want to consider in confronting a problem like this, I think economics as the kind of study of those choices is kind of inescapable in making sure that we make good decisions when an emergency like this hits.
What is the, you're doing a reference, I think, for anyone who's not aware of the title. What is the title referring to?
Economics in One Virus is a play on a famous book by Henry Hazlitt, which is Economics in One Lesson. Economics in One Lesson tried to portray that, in Henry's view, the most important kind of lesson in economics is that when considering a decision or an action, we have to think about not just the seen or observed consequences, but the unseen and unobserved consequences. And he explained that lesson through a range of different case studies in what truly is a kind of classic economic text. My book is attempting to do something different. It's trying to provide readers with a kind of whistle-stop tour of a whole range of different economic principles and ideas, but through the one case study, the broad case study of the pandemic. So that's why it's kind of a play on that title.
We've talked a lot about the effects of the pandemic on the economy broadly, but it's been a little bit odd and complicated because on the one hand, a lot of people lost their jobs or had their income reduced. But on the other hand, the stock market, I mean, it went down initially, but it has been on, you know, a record-setting upwards tear ever since. And many of us who didn't lose our jobs are feeling financially pretty okay because, if nothing else, our expenses may have gone down while our incomes remained the same. And so if we're talking about the impact on economic welfare of the last year of the virus, how do we go about measuring that, given this kind of complexity of experience?
Well, it's incredibly difficult to measure, and that's one reason why ordinarily, particularly libertarian economists, wouldn't attempt to kind of tot up social welfare as a function, because clearly the way that people value different things, the consumption of different goods and services, their liberties is incredibly subjective. So it's incredibly difficult to sum that up across a population. But what a lot of people do when they talk about economics is they describe it as if economics is essentially just the same as people's financial situations. And clearly, our financial situations as individuals in households or as a country overall is an important component of our well-being. But our well-being is enhanced by a whole range of things that don't crop up in our personal finances or GDP. So in thinking about this as a kind of economic shock, yes, we have to consider what has happened to GDP and people's personal finances, but we also have to try to account for the value of the lost liberties as a result of this pandemic, and also the economic welfare costs of the health aspects of the pandemic, because we know from behavior in markets that people highly value their health and they highly value their lives, because when they're willing to trade off aspects of their health or risks of death in work, they require quite high degrees of compensation to account for those extra risks that they're bearing. So in thinking about, you know, the overall economic welfare consequences of this pandemic, we have to think about not just the kind of lost output, but the lost value of the liberties and the economic welfare costs more broadly defined of the health consequences of the pandemic.
So at the beginning of the pandemic, a little bit more than a year ago right now, it was a very uncertain time, and you weren't sure what people, whether you were dangerous or what people in your life could be dangerous or who you could be endangering, which seems like by itself just a really good reason to just kind of isolate. And you talk about that in terms of an externality, which we usually think about as like, if you use the word, factories polluting and things like this. So you could become an externality. But the thing I thought was interesting is, like, isn't that always true with disease? There nothing was really that different about COVID-19 in that way.
To a certain extent, as a society, we've accepted that, you know, the risks of cold and flu and other viruses like that, that there's kind of an inherent understanding that we have the right to go about our lives, and that if we do contract them, that's a kind of risk that we take. I think where COVID is concerned, the health consequences and the broader effects on those who catch the disease are, on average, a lot more severe than flu. You know, there's a debate around the exact number, but when you try and compare like with like on the kind of infection fatality rate, most of the data that I've seen suggests that it's 10 to 20 times more deadly than an ordinary flu across the population as a whole. So I think this is a bigger problem. But as you say, there's a kind of fundamental framework through which we can look at this from that kind of externality perspective. And the thorny issue that we're talking about here is that a range of us engage in kind of social activities. And me and you might decide to meet for a pint or something, Trevor, and we acknowledge the risks that we're facing. But as a result of that meeting, we could then risk passing on the virus, infecting others who were not party to that initial meeting. So we impose risk on third parties. And this is more difficult than many other externality problems because we actually can spread the virus when we're asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic. So we don't really, unless we have widespread testing of everybody every day, we don't really know who is infected. And so trying to come to some sort of agreement whereby we can compensate those that we're putting at risk is really impossible. Human networks are incredibly dense and overlapping. And so we have this big kind of general externality problem of this disease at a societal level. And, you know, sometimes, quite often, markets can find innovative ways of dealing with externality problems. If property rights are kind of assigned, we can come to some sort of compensation and judgments within markets. But this is a lot more difficult because, as I say, quite often we don't know who actually has the disease in the first place. And even when you do catch the disease, you don't know who you've caught it from. So it's quite difficult to assign the rights. And there's a broader kind of collective action problem, if you were, in the sense that society on the whole would probably be better if everybody stuck to some basic rules, which would enable us both to continue living our lives normally, but following these basic rules. And you know, avoid catching the disease. The issue with that, though, is that it's incredibly difficult to make sure that everybody sticks to those rules. And when the prevalence of the disease is low, we each have an individual incentive to kind of to be a bit more daring in our behavior. But because this thing can spread at an exponential rate if we act relatively normally, things can go rapidly downhill if we don't all stick to those rules. So I'm not pretending there's any easy answers here, but the case for some degree of coercion in trying to make sure that we all collectively stick to rules is a lot stronger than perhaps for many other externality problems that policymakers use to kind of justify government action. Of course, the extent to that coercive behavior and the forms in which it should take are a lot more debatable, and there's really mixed evidence on the different measures that have been used by governments around the world to try to deal with this problem.
The other aspect of externalities, which you mentioned, and is a maybe ironic or paradoxical when it comes to COVID-19, but people talk about negative externalities, like I discussed pollution from a factory, but there are positive externalities. I remember one of my professors always said, being beautiful is a positive externality, and maybe people should walk up and pay you because you exude beauty or smelling nice. But there's another one that comes with COVID-19, which is actually contributing to herd immunity. So how do you kind of weigh those two sides of being dangerous, but if you get the disease and recover, you're now a benefit to society?
Well, clearly having immunity to the disease does exhibit positive externalities, and that's the whole reason why governments go about subsidizing or encouraging vaccinations. It's exactly the same logic, and it's why one of the potential endpoints for this crisis, well, the only endpoint, I guess, eventually is a degree of herd immunity. When we get to such a level of immunity that transmission kind of stays relatively constant, we get the occasional outbreak, but at a societal level, we don't have these massive outbreaks that we've been seeing over the past year or so. And it's incredibly difficult. You know, clearly, once people have recovered from the disease, that is a positive for society in the sense that they're able to engage in more activities safely. In theory, they can serve others' needs, and it's one less vector for kind of spreading the disease from there in terms of that individual. Now, is there a way that we could kind of harness that power and think, we'll try and expand the positive externalities and minimize the negative externalities? Well, some economists quite early on talked about this in a similar way to the Great Barrington Declaration. You had MIT's Darren Acemoglu published a paper where he said, in an ideal world, we'd have much stronger constrictions on those who were highly at risk from the disease, and we'd allow more ordinary behavior among those at lower personal risk who perhaps be more likely in net terms to exhibit positive externalities through the pandemic. The problem is, as I kind of alluded to earlier, society is this dense combination of interlocking networks and dividing people up between those most likely to provide net positive externalities and net negative externalities is incredibly difficult in reality. People live in multi-generational households. A lot of people do jobs where they serve people in other risk groups. And it's proven, even in countries that have gone down the route of trying to a certain extent to deliver focused protection for those most highly at risk, it proves incredibly difficult to protect those individuals in a situation where prevalence of the disease is high in the broader community. So even why I think that's a kind of theoretically interesting argument, I don't think that thinking of this as that type of optimization problem, which economists are sometimes prone to do, kind of gets us very far in thinking about good policy in this pandemic.
As we talk about vaccines and approaching herd immunity, right now in the United States, there are some worrying signs, but overall things feel far more hopeful than they have at probably any time in the last year. You know, all of us know lots of people who are getting vaccinated if we're not vaccinated ourselves. And we're, the total number of people immune to this disease is going up at, millions per day. At the same time, we see these outbreaks. Michigan, as we're recording this, is skyrocketing. And so there are lots of calls to, in various places, return to strictly enforced measures of social distancing, masking, closing restaurants, potentially lockdowns, and so on. And that was a running theme throughout the last year. But what's the relationship between how we behave and these government policies? Like, do lockdowns actually do anything as far as changing our behavior, or do they tend to follow along on the behavior people are already engaging in?
Well, I think the net effect of lockdowns is context and time specific. If you look across the world as a whole, there doesn't seem to be anywhere, even in countries that didn't lock down, where you get a kind of escalating outbreak right the way through to a point where the country gets herd immunity and then the disease fizzles out. Now, that appears to suggest that once the prevalence of the disease gets high enough in the community, people change their behavior drastically. And as a result of that, the transmission rate of the virus falls. We get those kind of waves that we've seen in infection rates and deaths. So, you know, somebody who was opposed to lockdowns would look at that and say, see, behavior changes on its own. The issue is that the stage at which the prevalence threshold of the disease at which behavior changes dramatically appears to be quite a movable feast. It appears different within states and countries and across different countries over time, depending on the context. My instincts is, you know, you've mentioned the relationship between lockdowns and voluntary action. My instinct actually is that last spring when this virus first hit, commentators who are both kind of opposed to lockdowns vociferously and those that strongly supported them overrated lockdowns in terms of their impacts. I think there was huge voluntary changes to behavior, people spending much more time at home, not visiting certain outlets in those early days, and that actually the private voluntary behavioral response led the public in many respects. There's been some good work by economist Austin Goolsbee on this at the University of Chicago. He reckons that there was a downturn in kind of to the extent of 60 percentage points in consumer traffic fall across businesses as a whole, and that legal restrictions, if you compare kind of commuting zones with state and county boundaries with different policy regimes, you can kind of get some variation. Legal restrictions explain only about 7 percentage points of those 60 percentage points. So quite a small component. My instincts, therefore, are that lockdowns on the margin do have an impact in terms of further constraining our behavior. I mean, how could they not? In many respects, there's bound to be some people who'd be willing to continue to engage in activities absent lockdowns. But certainly in those early days, they were a small component of the overall behavioral response that we saw as a result of the virus. Now, that doesn't mean they're not important. It could be that that was the kind of straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of reducing the transmission rate of the virus below one, and so leading to a downturn in infections and deaths. Since then, I think that the evidence is much more messy. If you look at individual states, the relationship between states that have used lockdown measures in the period, say from May last year through to today, and their performance in terms of infections and deaths, there isn't really any clear evidence that we can take away from that. But, you know, I think on the margins, I think lockdowns do have an impact in terms of the public health effects. But of course, we have to balance that with the fact that they're incredibly crude impositions. And for the same reasons they have an impact on the public health side, they also come with very, very large economic costs too. And so it just to kind of take this back a step, I don't think anyone in this debate would look across countries over the past year and say, if we could go back and start this again, the optimal response would have been on-off use of lockdowns through the last year. I think clearly when you look at what other countries, particularly countries like Korea, Taiwan, some other East Asian countries have done, that has clearly been preferable both in terms of performance on public health and performance on economic activity and liberties too. But we have to judge individual lockdowns in the context and time at which they occur.
You made the used a word a couple times, margins, which some of our listeners may not be familiar with, but in this context, it's a good kind of teaching lesson, as the whole book is about. What is marginal thinking in the economic sense, thinking on the margins, and why does that matter? I mean, it's interesting when you talk about how much did the lockdown laws affect people's behavior. But I was thinking, well, the same question could be asked about murder laws. Like, are murder laws the primary reason people don't commit murder or the punishment for murder? It's the same basic idea, correct?
Yeah. So when we're talking about thinking on the margin, we're really saying that you should judge a kind of imposition or policy in this regard in terms of its impact over and above the kind of counterfactual that we're dealing with. So a good way to think about this is that I describe in the book actually is road building, right? We can look back at the economic effects of roads that have previously been built. And a lot of people, when they're trying to make the case for these big infrastructure projects that the likes of Joe Biden are now pushing, they'll say the building of the interstate highway system massively improved productivity and so GDP growth across the US. Okay, fine. We can argue about the underlying economics of that. But that doesn't really tell us much about what the net economic impact of a new road will be. That you have one highway system doesn't mean that you need to build another one or that that second highway system will have the same economic impacts as the first. And this is crucial to thinking about lockdowns and thinking about the individual regulations that implicitly make up lockdowns, because some of them in isolation will clearly have net positive marginal impacts, and some of them clearly will have net negative marginal impacts. So I don't believe, for example, that one implicit regulation wrapped up in stay-at-home orders is that you shouldn't travel across the state to go and stay in your second home that might be empty. Now, that clearly has barely any public health benefit, but does come with a cost to the individual in terms of not being able to perhaps move to somewhere where they'd be more comfortable staying for the duration of that lockdown. And when we think about lockdowns as those kind of bundles of implicit regulations, there's clearly a lot of things that could have been stripped out of them, which have net negative consequences for society.
When we're weighing these policies and we're looking at the cost to society of different options for reducing deaths, one of the potentially ghoulish things we have to look at is how do we trade off lives saved against, say, economic costs or liberty costs or other things that we might find valuable? Because we could, I mean, obviously, there are ways that we could have prevented all or most COVID deaths, but they would have been, we could lock everyone in individual rooms for a year. But we're not willing to bear that cost. What does economics tell us about making that kind of unfortunate calculus?
Well, economics in theory is well placed to make these kind of judgments because we use quite often cost-benefit analysis as part of our toolkit, where we kind of try and kind of broadly define all the economic welfare costs of a particular decision and weigh that against all the economic welfare benefits of a particular decision. And if the benefits exceed the costs, then we know that the project is kind of sound and worth considering. Of course, you have to think carefully that a benefit cost ratio is above one. And so, the project is sound on benefit cost grounds doesn't mean that it would be the optimal policy. It might be that there's a completely different set of proposals that could achieve a higher benefit to cost ratio. But when thinking about this kind of COVID crisis, although that framework, is a useful kind of starting point, there are a range of quite big difficulties in working out the costs and benefits in reality. So, working out the benefits of, say, a social distancing restriction mandated by the government, one would have to try and consider, first of all, how many lives or what health impact that regulation would have on the margin. And to do that well, you have to define the counterfactual of what would happen absent that measure. You also then have to apply evaluation of the kind of value of the number of statistical lives in that framework that you'd be saving, which is itself quite a controversial area of economics. Economists tend to think that the value of statistical life, so that is the value of mitigating a death risk through a regulation, say, they tend to value each individual life in that regard quite highly, but there's a wide range of values that economists would calculate depending on how you go about doing it. And then on the cost side, of course, you have the same issues in many ways. You have to try and ascertain what the baseline downturn, say, in GDP would be as a result of people voluntarily adjusting to this virus and try and work out what the marginal impact of any new restriction on top of that voluntary behavioral change would be. And of course, you have to try and account for the losses of liberties, which have very subjective values. If I was to miss the funeral of an important family member as a result of a lockdown regulation, that clearly would have a high, very high personal cost to me. Looking at GDP or something like that alone wouldn't account for this cost. Now, those are incredibly subjective. Policymakers are particularly well-placed in terms of calculating them. But if they're going to decide on these major consequential decisions that have massive costs and massive benefits, they should at least try to consider some sort of valuation of those lost liberties as well. So I guess to answer your question, Aaron, we do have frameworks as economists for trying to think about these things, and they usually apply to much smaller projects such as, you know, building a new, the economic case for building a new bridge. A lot of these issues become much more difficult to calculate in reality when you're talking about society-wide restrictions during an emergency pandemic scenario.
Back to the ghoulishness issue, it seems that valuing a statistical life is a little ghoulish, and maybe this is why economists don't make many friends at parties or something, because they kind of break everything down in that way. But you mentioned that the value of going to a loved one's funeral is subjective and it could be very high, but isn't the value of a family member to someone just, you know, something you can't really put a price tag on? Why would we even try to do that?
Well, inevitably, we have to try to do it when we're thinking about public policy decisions, because we're not talking about individual valuations. We're talking about how much costs should other people in society outside of your family bear for the imposition of some sort of regulation on their lives. Now, the way that economists tend to do this is to look at people's willingness to pay in labor markets. So in a lot of jobs, for example, where there's an elevated mortality risk, perhaps, you know, you're doing a job where you're having to climb skyscrapers, or you're working in a dangerous mine or whatever, there's quite often what economists would describe as a compensating differential. So relative to other jobs that are in similar fields, but aren't quite as dangerous, an individual would tend to be paid a premium to work in a more dangerous job. And this variation between the elevated risk of death in the job and the extra amount that somebody has to be paid to compensate them for taking that job can be used to calculate across all workers in that industry the amount that they collectively would have to be paid in order to compensate them for the statistical risk of one person dying. So I know that sounds like a mouthful, but what we're talking about when we talk about a value of a statistical life is the amount that a group in society would have to be paid collectively to bear the cost of a risk which would likely lead to any given member of that group dying. Now, that's not the same as a valuation of a human life. That, say, we have, we collectively need to be paid $10 million to risk somebody in society potentially dying because of an elevated mortality risk, doesn't mean that any given person would accept $10 million in return for certain death. But when we're thinking about public policy decisions, we have to try and account for the value of mitigating death risks, and that's the way that economists try to calculate them. Now, are those appropriate when, are those kind of labor market study values appropriate when thinking through an issue like COVID-19? There might be reasons to think that actually those valuations that we take from labor market studies are too high. A lot of those valuations come from trade-offs for working age people. Older people tend to have much more varied willingness to pay valuations than working age people that are often in quite similar cohorts within a particular industry. And we know that the kind of death risks associated with COVID-19 are massively higher for the elderly than the young. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, we have to, when we're making public policy decisions, we can't act as if every individual life is of infinite value. Otherwise, we would all be at home stuck in those bubbles that Aaron talked about. So we have to find some way of trading things off. The value of a statistical life provides a framework for thinking through the valuations associated with reducing death risks, whether the exact figure that we kind of commonly hear is right, given the populations affected, I'm less certain about.
One of the really striking things this last year, watching the pandemic unfold and our response to it adapt to that, is not just how little we know and how much we continue to not know about the specific nature of the virus and its spread, but also the economic consequences, the social consequences, but two, how much what we thought we knew at any given time turned out to be wrong, turned out to change. And this would seem to cause a tremendous problem for any sort of centralized response to this. If you're the government and you have to figure out what policies to adopt, you have to operate on the knowledge you have, and that knowledge might be wrong or it might change tomorrow. And this is a country of, you know, hundreds of millions of people in lots of different circumstances, as we talked about. This sounds a lot like the knowledge problem in economics that we libertarians love to talk about. So what is that, and how does that apply to the COVID situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one could always imagine, in a kind of static world in theory, if somebody was able to collect all the information about the way that we live our lives and our preferences and our abilities to produce and our productivity and everything else, you could insert all of those values into a computer and come up with the best way of perhaps, in this case, minimizing deaths, or in other cases, generating the most economic output. In reality, of course, a lot of the things that are inherent in why we're productive as individuals entail incredibly local knowledge. The best way to manage us as individuals, our experience in dealing with particular situations that might only arise on occasions, but perhaps most importantly, the fact that society in reality is dynamic. We're not just kind of static atoms affected by outside forces. In reality, we're continually adapting to the circumstances around us, and we're pretty entrepreneurial in the broadest sense of the term. We're testing out new things constantly and realizing that we have preferences when new goods become available that we didn't even know existed before. So you're right, Aaron. This makes a challenge like COVID-19 incredibly difficult for policymakers to deal with. Initially, they were dealing with the fact that there was huge uncertainty about the virus itself, how this thing was transmitted. You know, we sometimes forget that in those early days, there was much less discussion of this being an airborne virus and much more discussion of hand washing as a key way of preventing this from spreading. We didn't really know
the days when I was wiping down my groceries. You mean those days?
Exactly, yeah.
When we were wiping down our deliveries and all that stuff.
And when we were all going to the stores looking for hand sanitizer. There was much less obvious knowledge about whether in the future a vaccine or therapeutics were going to be decent therapeutics were going to be available. We didn't know how individuals or we collectively would actually react when having a lot of these social distancing regulations imposed upon us. And as a result of that, this produces a big problem. One issue with this is that unlike kind of within market activity, government activity doesn't tend to have those mechanisms inherent within it for rapid error correction when things are clearly wrong, for adjusting quickly, because we don't have those responses through changed consumer behavior and prices that we see in ordinary markets. And I think this is kind of evident in some of the mistakes that have been made through this pandemic, which I'm sure we will talk about in more detail. But I think the main lesson from all of this is that there are probably areas where public officials can try to propagate the information to the best of their abilities at given times, and they should be honest and outline where there's uncertainty. But I think at a localized level, they should, as far as possible, allow adaptation and try and remove barriers to us adjusting our lives to try and deal with a new situation. So they've done that to a certain extent. We've had to remove a whole raft of different regulations on industries to allow industries to move into new sectors, you know, distilleries becoming hand sanitizer manufacturers. We've had to allow, which are positive in the longer term too, but there's been much more in the way of telehealth as a result of temporary deregulations of the provision of healthcare and a whole range of other things. And I think that is representative of this broader issue that when a crisis like this hits, the most powerful tool that we have as a society as a whole is our ability to adapt to the new circumstances. And while public policy can play a role in shaping that, evidently, I think it's much better for policymakers to try and set the broad principles or the basic information and then allow individuals and businesses to try and adjust as best they can given the local knowledge that they have of their particular situation.
As is so often the case when something big like this happens, you get competing sides who come in and say the government is the one that's going to fix this and did fix it, and then maybe the libertarians say, oh no, the free market is going to be the one that fixed it, and it was the one that ultimately fixed it. In some regards, we talked about some of these regulations. You mentioned a few of them that were harmful to at least adjustment. But there were some that came out of the FDA in terms of just the way that we were able to achieve testing. And you write about that in the book, which they're still seemingly dragging their feet on for home testing. Why did that take so long?
Well, I think, you know, there's inertia in any public body. But I think behind those mistakes was just a fundamental error of economic reasoning. And that error essentially was to incorrectly define the kind of counterfactual as I described earlier, and as a result to miscalculate the costs and benefits of the regulations as they stood. So when the pandemic hit, the FDA introduced its emergency use authorization procedure for the tests, which actually threw up new hurdles to a lot of labs who would ordinarily be able to undertake PCR tests from doing them. But the reason why they introduced that was because they were worried that if those tests were slightly inaccurate, it would give public health officials a false impression of the state of the pandemic. Well, of course, you know, that is something that one should be worried about. We obviously all in an ideal world want more accurate tests. But at the time, the alternative that we faced to having slightly inaccurate tests was actually having no tests. And as a result of having no tests, or at least very few tests available to the population as a whole at that time, tons of people were walking around as false negatives. They had the disease, were infected with it without realizing it. And ultimately, as a result of not being able to isolate more of those individuals early on, we all then had to live our lives as if we were false positives, as if everybody that we came across potentially was infected with the disease, even though the vast majority of them weren't. So I think that was a really costly kind of first mistake in the pandemic. Some people have described it as a kind of the original sin that made everything else more difficult. I'm not sure that testing ever would have been the silver bullet in the United States, simply because I think the community spread of the disease was probably higher than we'd have expected. But that initial error took the kind of South Korean option of a test and trace approach to this pandemic off the table straight away. And kind of downstream of that introduced a whole range of the problems that we've seen since then. Now, you mentioned, Trevor, that we didn't kind of learn from that mistake. And up until very, very recently, the FDA was still holding back the approval of rapid home tests, in part because they were judging them as a diagnostic tool for a diagnostic test for the disease, for a kind of infection, as opposed to treating them as a broader public health measure that could help on the margin. If we'd have been able to undertake more of these tests, which everybody knows are less sensitive than the PCR tests, that means you probably get more false negatives, people who are actually infected who don't show up on these tests yet. You know, that is a problem with these tests relative to PCR tests. But the alternative to most people when they wake up and decide to do a test is not a PCR test being able to be done straight away and being able to isolate soon afterwards. It's seeing how they feel, judging whether they've got a temperature, and then deciding whether they should go about their work. So on the margin, I think these rapid at-home tests, as we've seen at certain universities and within the MBA and other organizations with regular testing, I think could have helped isolate more infectious people more quickly than otherwise, and at a community level could have helped reduce transmission of the disease, and as a result led to more activities being undertaken relatively safely. But that was taken off the table because these tests were judged in the same way as ordinary diagnostic tools, as opposed to them being a kind of community disease management tool. And you see this mistake, this implicit calculation of the costs and benefits as a result of not defining the counterfactual again and again and again through this. You know, you could talk about the failure to approve the AstraZeneca vaccine more recently, for example. There were some problems in some of the early trials of AstraZeneca, and the FDA weren't happy with the way that they reported their data. But on the margin, you know, were the benefits of making them undertake a domestic US trial really worth the costs of not getting those extra doses in arms and getting more people in the US a degree of protection from this virus? I don't see how those marginal benefits could even in theory overcome the large marginal costs of the extra infections and deaths that we've seen. So we see this problem being repeated again and again through this pandemic.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because it was somewhat of a disturbing report, I felt like, shortly after they announced the first vaccine, that it came out that the vaccine actually existed in January of 2020. It was invented within days. And that raises this question of, did the FDA really just kind of ultimately have a net negative by delaying this? I mean, can you imagine if we were all getting vaccinated in March, March a year ago? Does that say bad for what the FDA does in general, that it's like overly risk averse all the time, but especially in situations like this?
We've seen an announcement today that actually, as a consequence of a lot of these changes to regulations and the speeding up that we have seen in this past year, it appears that there's been dramatic progress in provisions of a potential vaccine for HIV, which suggests that some of those costs from the precautionary behavior that we've seen have had big societal consequences even prior to this pandemic. Now, I can understand in part why, even though things have been sped up, and I think, you know, on the margin, Operation Warp Speed probably did help speed things up, and the FDA evidently have been working with these companies to try and streamline some of the ordinary trial procedures. I think that there are concerns that people would have had if, you know, there'd been a vaccine available within a couple of months. But there are things that we could have done in terms of speeding it up further, if we'd rethought our ethical and regulatory frameworks around human challenge trials, and allowed young and healthy individuals to participate in, you know, being paid an amount to bear the risk of being deliberately infected with the virus as part of a vaccine trial, we could have potentially brought this forward a few extra months, and a few extra months in terms of the rollout of this vaccine, given the large ongoing economic and public health costs, could have been pretty dramatic in terms of its net benefits for society. But I just reiterate, I mean, I do think that this was more of a thorny issue for policymakers, in the sense that a vaccine is no good if people are unwilling to take it. And I think if it had been available within a month or two, even though it was produced pretty early and appears to have been safe from pretty early on, there may have been a consequence in terms of a much less willingness to take it. So there is a degree of a trade-off there. But yes, Trevor, you're right. I think this episode does prove that a lot of the precautionary behavior that we see does have much bigger social costs. And I would also say it highlights a degree of parochialism as well, because this trial data was interpreted very differently from many other public health agencies and vaccine and drug regulators around the world. And I don't really understand why there couldn't be more coordination in terms of picking up the phone and talking through some of the issues with them, which presumably to an extent was going on, as opposed to making the company rerun, in AstraZeneca's case, the whole trial in the United States, holding things up for months and months and months.
Early on, we saw a lot of shortages. Toilet paper, and also hand sanitizer was quite hard to get. Masks were also hard to get. And one of the results of that was that when you could find them, they were hugely expensive. You know, if you went on Amazon, hand sanitizer was at a crazy high cost, toilet paper as well. Third-party sellers popped up to provide it at, what looked like ludicrous prices. And there was a lot of concern about this price gouging, that this was people taking advantage of our sudden need for these products. Is that bad? Is it bad when sellers jack up prices like that? Are they kind of screwing all of us?
Well, I think it's just reflective of the reality of the situation. Now, every market is very, very different. I think in the case of toilet paper that you mentioned, for example, the big issue there is that we were, as a result of spending far less time at work and far more time at home, we were not demanding the commercial grade toilet paper, which is usually lower quality, but we're willing to accept when we go to the bathroom at work, and we're substituting our demand for the stuff at home. So there's that big demand shift. And actually, it was quite difficult for producers to reorient production. Quite often, different producers of the different types of toilet paper. So there were kind of near-term shortages whilst some of the home toilet paper producers kind of had to ramp up their operations, which is why we saw short-term shortages on the shelves. Prices are governed by supply and demand. We talk as if companies can charge whatever they like for their goods and services. They can only charge what people are willing to pay. And as a result of this crisis, a whole range of products were in much higher demand than they were previously. Now, what would happen ordinarily in that scenario is that a rising price would occur. Producers would notice that rising price. Some of the people who had newly demanded, say, hand sanitizer would think, the price is a bit higher now. I'm not sure that I really need to buy two whole packets of this stuff. Maybe I'll just stick to one, or maybe I'll just stick to a couple for my handbag. So there'd be a kind of offsetting reduction in the quantity demanded, which would partially ameliorate that initial increase in demand. And some of the suppliers would think, well, as a result of this higher price, we're potentially going to make a bigger markup on each individual order. So actually, it might be worth us economically paying our staff overtime, running the machines hotter, perhaps even investing in a couple of different machines to meet this new demand. Now, as a society, at a societal level, there's going to be near-term shortages. But that price rise over time leads to the amelioration of the shortages on shelves. There's overall more traded, but at higher prices. And in time, one would imagine that companies will enter the market and invest in the production such that prices would come back down. Now, what have we seen in this crisis? Well, there's two things really that have resulted in a situation where we had sustained shortages and then very high prices online. Firms for a long time, particularly the big retail outlets and the big pharmacies, have been worried about the reputational consequences of being seen to hike prices of particular goods in demand in emergencies. We see this always with hurricanes and storms everywhere. Big companies like Walmart are kind of, they think it's, it would be a hit to their reputation to raise prices. So they don't tend to raise prices. They tend to then bring supply in from nearby areas to try and deal with any near-term shortages that we've seen. In this situation, though, the pandemic was affecting the country as a whole, so we couldn't see those kind of offsetting effects from elsewhere. So a combination of companies being unwilling to raise prices through their reputational impact drove a lot of activity to these less liquid markets online, so we saw the higher prices. But then on top of that, of course, we have state-level anti-price gouging laws, which seek to punish companies that sometimes raise prices above a particular level. Sometimes they're kind of not clear as to exactly what degree of price rises are allowed. And as a result of that, on the margin, at least, fewer companies are willing to enter the sector and provide the extra supply to meet that demand. So we see sustained shortages. To answer your question kind of more directly, Aaron, I don't have a view of whether I don't have like a value judgment view of whether it's good or not. I just see the price changes as a reflection of the reality of the situation. And if we want to suppress that price message and pretend that everything is fine and everybody will be able to fulfill their demands at ordinary prices, then we're going to see sustained shortages.
Given all these lessons, one of the things that has seemed to come up in this discussion is we made mistakes. We did some things correctly. Sometimes we made the same mistake a bunch of times, being overly cautious with the FDA, perhaps overly imposing lockdowns, maybe. But so what do we do? What do we learn? Are you optimistic? Are you that we've learned, you know, if another pandemic hits, I mean, we're not out of this one yet, but it seems like there's a light at the end of the tunnel. If another pandemic hits in 2030, do you think that we'll have better lessons, or does there sort of the machinery of government and human behavior kind of run the same playbook over and over again?
Well, it depends, I think, on the contours of the pandemic. I think if we were to be hit with a very, very similar virus, then we probably would see a better response next time, in part because the political incentives have changed. There'd be big political costs to not fighting the last war after this and ensuring that the testing regulatory framework was better. There'll probably be a whole bunch of demands after this for governments to invest in excess capacity of the production of face masks and ventilators and a whole range of other things that would have been useful in hindsight to have in this crisis, but which we didn't early on. But of course, if the next pandemic or the next crisis that hits is very different in nature, I don't see any inherent reason why we would why this experience would make us better prepared for that. There's a big economic literature which actually shows that the political incentives to prepare for low probability, high risk events is incredibly low. And in part, that's because of elections. If you look, there's been some fun papers that have looked at whether politicians are rewarded for making kind of preparatory investments in things that would help when crises like hurricanes or tornadoes or things like that hit. And what that literature tends to find is that we as electors don't reward those that invest in the preparation, in part because we don't observe it, or you know, a crisis doesn't actually occur. Or if it does occur, we just presume that things would have been fine anyway. But we do tend to reward politicians that, when it does hit, provide us with extensive relief and take emergency actions quickly. So I suspect that, you know, thinking through those political incentives, I think coming out of this, there'll probably be, you know, lots of different commissions and retrospective analyses that will look at the individual decisions that have been made and highlight where there have been mistakes. We will then spend vast amounts trying to correct those observable mistakes, but a lot of them have been very regulatory and testing issues aside, a lot of them have been very specific to the circumstances of this pandemic. And the key lesson that I think should be taken away from this is that real resilience comes from our ability to quickly adapt to very, very different situations. So if the next pandemic, as I say, is very similar to this, then just like some of the East Asian countries have experienced SARS and MERS have seemed to deal better with this crisis, I think we would be better placed in 2030. The problem is crises have a tendency not to replicate the thing that has just happened. And if something very different will occur, say something that affects the domestic situation more than the international situation, then it might turn out that investing in a whole bunch of capacity onshore in the United States actually leaves us more vulnerable to the next crisis and not better prepared for it.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy Free Thoughts, make sure to rate and review us in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. Free Thoughts is produced by Landry Ayers. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.